The workman levelling the tarmac on the pavement outside my home looked at me with twinkling eyes as I bribed him unashamedly with a four-pack of lager. "Oh, be jabers, sir," he said with a brogue that I suspect was more for effect than authenticity. "I'll do that for yez, so's I will." Moments later, he was on the driveway as I called out to my mother. "Remember, I always promised you I'd sit you in a roller." Oh, how he laughed. A long-held promise was fulfilled, albeit not quite in the way my mother expected, as my quasi-Irish friend posed gleefully for the obligatory photos. Driving a roller, that's a Rolls-Royce, not the road-flattening variant, is for many car enthusiasts the ultimate in motoring indulgence. It is a fabulous experience, the silk-smooth engine gliding the plot along in a sublime cocoon of comfort, where the loudest noise really is the dashboard clock, so unreal as to be surreal. Of course, it doesn't have to be a roller. My other half prefers Bentleys, Aston Martins and TVRs, none of which are likely to be occupying too much of my workshop space any time soon. But we can all dream. Ah, the motor car. No one can remember a time without them being part of our lives. We all have our starting points, and I distinctly recall mine being 1962, a mustard-coloured Austin A35 van. 3661FD allowed my young parents to extend their experiences beyond the range of pedal cycles, buses and trains. The freedom of our car and the open road, with petrol at 3 and 6 pence a gallon, for the uninitiated that 17 and a half pence, allowed us to go where and when we wanted, unfettered by timetables and prescribed routes. I fondly remember as an 8-year-old how I sat on a cushion, looking in wonderment out of the rear window as the world sped backwards. My father became an addict, and although we didn't have 2 pennies to rub together at the time, he always found the money to afford a car. He wasn't pretentious by any means, a humble man who left school at 15. His car was hardly the mark of a man above his station. It was how he chose to reward himself for his sheer hard graft and determination to get on in life. It was his badge of office. It is thus no surprise that I should be persuaded by his passion, and I too have been fortunate to enjoy some lovely automobiles. Although I have appreciated the plush luxury of the big stuff, I have long been a devotee of the diminutives, and some that I have owned have been amongst the smallest on the road. Not so when I developed my passion for motorcycles and became an adherent of the American philosophy, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got cubes. Cubic capacity, that is. And gosh, have I ridden some monsters. Not for speed, more the challenge of handling the beasts. After all, it has long been my maxim that if you have exchanged lots of money for a gleaming machine with enough chrome to cover a small asteroid, then the last thing you want to do is drive past people so fast they can't see you. Now that's style. But, and here's an amazing fact, the A35 van my father bought in the 1960s, the cars he subsequently owned, the fire-breathing behemoths I have ridden, all have one thing in common. The 4-stroke internal combustion engine. I am unilaterally dismissing the 2-stroke expressions, nasty spitting contrivances that may be fine in gardening tools, but for me have little merit in road vehicles. Or diesel engines, like millions of others, I was conned by our government, yes, I stand by the word conned, into going diesel by the lure of greater longevity and cheaper fuel, only to now being made to feel socially irresponsible every time I fill my tank with particulates. Then there's the rotary engine, a curious animal if ever, popularised by the West German NSU RO80 saloon of the 1960s, and the Japanese Mazda rotary that featured in several of its sports cars. They were also developed by Norton Motorcycles and raced with some success. As I recall, the bike attracted debate as to whether the swept volume of the rotor, depending on how it was measured, amounted to 600 or 1200 cc. I rode one once. It was blisteringly crisp, but to me it was no 1200. Then there is the quirkily eccentric Stirling or external combustion engine. I think I'll leave you to look that one up for yourself. Yet let me not digress with these diversions. The bulk of the world's motor cars have been and still are powered by a device that has its roots deep in Victorian times. The materials may have changed, the efficiency improved, the fuel system modified, the emissions lessened, the electrics upgraded, the whole unit controlled by more computing power that put man on the moon. But in essence, the internal combustion engine in your car is based on a principle first developed by a French engineer, Alfonso Beau de Rocha, following a patent in 1861. Numerous famous names sprang up on the subsequent explosion of car manufacturers. Many fell by the wayside, but some are still there with us from those halcyon times. Mercedes-Benz, 1883. Skoda, 1895. Renault, 1899. Fiat, also 1899, Cadillac, 1901. It's quite a list. From our comfortable leather seats, heading at 70 miles an hour along a tarmac motorway, we can reflect in bemusement to the time when it was a legal requirement to travel at no more than 4 miles per hour, accompanied by someone walking in front carrying a red flag. Though regulations were gradually relaxed, until 1935 you didn't even need a license to do so. The four-stroke cycle is also called the Otto cycle, after the German Nikolaus Otto, who used spark plugs to fire cylinders in an order of induction, compression, ignition and exhaust. To avoid excess vibration, four-cylinder cars have commonly worked on a cylinder firing sequence of 1, 2, 4, 3, with the up and down movement of the pistons being converted to reciprocal motion of a flywheel via the crank. This is astonishing and worthy of just pausing a moment to reflect that despite advances in nuclear energy, hydrogen fuel cells, solar panels, lithium batteries, and a whole raft of wonderful technological advances, that gleaming modern four-wheeled thingy with all the bells and whistles parked in your garage right now is still powered by a device that has remained fundamentally unchanged in over 160 years. That statistic alone is probably ample justification for why its time is coming to a close. The denouement, the time when internal combustion engine cars will no longer be available in the UK, was set some months ago at the year 2040, long enough for us all to get used to it. So, it came as a jolt to be told this week that it has been brought forward to 2030. With hybrids phased out by 2035. Gosh, that's almost tomorrow. The internal combustion engine, or at least its incarnation in cars and motorcycles, has in fact been under threat for almost as many years as it has existed. Lobbyists for just about everything from noise, congestion, pollution, antisocial behaviour, industrial relations, road safety. Bridget Driscoll, having the distinction of being the first recorded pedestrian to be killed by an automobile in 1896, even religion and politics have protested in some way right from the days that Henry Ford declared of his Model T in 1909, any customer can have a car painted any colour that he wants, so long as it is black. The Model T only came in black so the production line efficiency could be improved. Even in those pioneering days, the economics of production were paramount. Car production has survived the tirades, so it is somewhat ironic that its demise has been heralded, not so much by humankind's objections, but nature's interventions in the way of fossil fuel depletion, pollution and global warming, none of which were remotely on the horizon back in Henry's prime. In the meantime, the magnificent motor car has become so ingrained as a fundament of our very existence that this side of it happening, it is hard to envisage it not being so anymore. One investment company newsletter recently described it as automotive Armageddon. Still, I suppose they said that at the end of the age of steam. But it is disheartening to imagine that from fashion to film, remember the breathtaking car chase featuring Steve McQueen in Bullet that's been reinterpreted numerous times since but never bettered. From functional transport to sumptuous statement of wealth, it will all be no more. And there is no question that something indefinable will be lost forever. As for the new order, that prospective concomitant issues of battery manufacture and disposal, charging infrastructure and upgrade of the national grid already disturb me greatly. But they are for another day. Existing internal combustion cars will survive for many years, though I predict they will eventually become the prerogative of enthusiasts, much as the aforementioned steam, traction engines, beam pumps and the Flying Scotsman are now the stuff of legend. Perhaps one day you too will find yourself in a museum pointing out to your grandkids what was once your favourite old jalopy. So I leave the final word to one who has already expressed it all so eloquently. Jeremy Clarkson, formerly of BBC's Top Gear, until an ignominious fall from grace following his assault on a producer, is nonetheless a talented broadcaster. For the conclusion of the 13th series in 2009, he presented a minor masterpiece of emotive prescience, not so much a programme as 4 minutes of mellifluous artistry. Picture the scene, glorious rolling isolated scenery, with a single track road passing not a building nor living soul save for frolicking deer. A gleaming pearlescent silver vehicle of demonically sensuous lines, purring around corners and roaring on straights, all accompanied by pacifying music from the maestro of the ethereal, Brian Eno. A pensive Clarkson at the wheel glances towards the camera in tacit acknowledgement. Well, it's an Aston Martin Vantage with a V12 engine. So what do you think it's going to be like? More music, more scenery, more purring and roaring, Clarkson's voice again. It is fantastic. It is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. What it makes me feel, though, is sad. I just can't help thinking that thanks to all sorts of things, the environment, the economy, problems in the Middle East, the relentless war on speed, cars like this will soon be consigned to the history books. I just have this horrible, dreadful feeling that what I am driving here is an ending. More music, more scenery, more purring and roaring, before a clearly wistful Clarkson, in a masterclass of minimalist commentary that left one pondering whether he was closing a series or foreshadowing the end of an era, simply says, good night.